Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Prop Wash Pod, a podcast that shares the histories from heroes of the Air Force Airborne Security Service during the Cold War. I'm your host, Jeffrey Pidlown, amateur historian, and today we'll be talking to retired Chief Master Sergeant Mel Hagan, who served in the Air Force as an airborne language analyst for over 20 years, between September 1965 and August 1986. He's lived in Ona Village, Okinawa since 1979, and spent his first retirement from the Air Force working as an education administrator consultant before his second retirement in 2017. In the first part of the podcast, Chief Mel talks about his early experiences in the security service and time serving in the Vietnam War, while the second part transitions to his time after retiring and living life in Okinawa, before ultimately sharing some life lessons that will be valuable for all of our listeners. Without further ado, here's my interview with Chief Mel Hagan.
Could you please introduce yourself? Tell us where you're from.
My name is Mel Hagan, and I'm originally from Altoona, Pennsylvania. Born there in August of 1947. And I'd like to say that, I probably had a fairly normal childhood. Two brothers, two sisters, although the one brother came the year I entered the Air Force, so he's the oops kid. When I look back at my childhood, I had a pretty interesting, laid-back, good parents, just a good time to grow up.
And where do you live now?
I live in Okinawa, up in the village of Ona. For those of you that are familiar with Okinawa, I live in Nakodomati, which is right north of the Okinawa Renaissance Resort Hotel. I live in the resort area and love it.
Yeah, I've been there, and yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. So you talked about your childhood and how it was a pretty good childhood. What would you say were, the reasons that made you want to join the military?
It's actually kind of convoluted. In high school, I was a wrestler. My uncle was the head wrestling coach at Bucknell University at the time, and he got me into wrestling when I was like in sixth or seventh grade, made the freshman wrestling team. But all through high school, while I was wrestling, I had this idea that I wanted to be a priest. And after I graduated, I went to the Franciscan Monastery in Loretto, Pennsylvania, to be a third order regular brother and then eventually be in the priesthood. But I started to become disenchanted, not with the religion per se, but I realized that maybe it wasn't my calling, it was my mom's calling, and I was following up on it. So in September, I decided to drop out of the monastery. And since that was the beginning, the early days of the Vietnam conflict, I lost my draft deferment. So on the way home from the monastery, I stopped to see the Navy recruiter, and he was closed. But the Air Force recruiter was in the same building, so I joined the Air Force.
Wow, yeah. It's funny. There's actually a lot of people who have a similar story where they'd be recruited by one service and end up in another.
My dad was good with my dad was a Navy veteran. In fact, he was here in the Battle of Okinawa, and he told me, don't join the Navy. But I was, I was going to be stubborn, but hey, the guy was at lunch.
Yeah, hey, you know what? Yeah, you make your own destiny. And so you joined the Air Force. Can you tell us about your time? Maybe give us a quick overview and, tell us about your time in the Air Force.
I did fairly well on the ASVAB tests. I've always had good short-term memory and good taking multiple-choice tests. So they wanted me to do some type of electronics thing, which scared me because I didn't know anything about electronics. And I asked them, how did I do on the language test that they made us all take? And they said, oh, God, yeah, you're going to be a linguist. And they sent probably 300 or 400 of us that did well on the artificial language test to a screening test. And a guy named Bob Tharp, who founded the Chinese Mandarin Oral Comprehension course at Yale and then moved it to Monterey, was there screening us. And the way they did it is they'd teach you 2 or 3 hours of Chinese, and you'd take a test, then go to lunch or something like that, come back in the afternoon, and you find out that half of you are gone. and he'd teach you another hour or so and give you another test, and you come back a little bit later, and you know, they weeded it down. Eventually there were 91 of us left, and they told us we were going to Yale University to learn Chinese. When I completed basic training, though, I was put on casual status, and while I was on casual, they said, well, you're not really going to Yale, you're going to this place called Monterey. So I went there. I think we were the first full class. There was a partial class that had been moved from Yale, but completed the basic language training, follow-on technical school, and another one of those ironic things, I was not originally scheduled to go airborne. I didn't score well enough when I was in class at the basic tech school. Uh-huh. And one person in front of me failed the flight physical, another one declined to fly, and another one got sick and had to be set back. And they came and asked me, would I like to go to airborne? I had an assignment to Peshawar, Pakistan, already in hand. And I asked them, well, where would the airborne assignment be? And they said, Japan. And to me, that was a no-brainer. Pakistan, Japan. I said, yeah, I'll go airborne. And kind of lucked into it, really. Had a great time, some great instructors. Ended up going to the 6988 at Yokota. Was one of the volunteers to initiate the 6990th. Came down to Okinawa in the second large mass, I mean literally mass, to stretched DC-8s filled with military members and their families, moved from Yokota to Okinawa, and that was the 2nd of September. Another group had come down a little bit earlier in August, about the same size. I must say that Kadena learned from the first group, because when we came in on the second group, they bussed us all to the theater, and they brought CBPO and everybody to us, housing office, everything. They processed us en masse rather than trying to do everything. Thus, my adventures with the 90th began. I stayed here until April. That was in September of 1967. I stayed until April of 1970. I married a beautiful Okinawan lady who is still my wife. And at the time, everybody was losing their security clearance for marrying a foreign national. Colonel Larson, later General Larson, the commander, went out on a limb, and he got several of us to keep our security clearances in exchange for us being sent to Goodfellow to work in the airborne program as instructors, myself and three Vietnamese linguists. So I never lost my clearance, which kind of surprised me. I was all ready to be a bowling alley superintendent or something. At the same time, when I redid my flight physical, I was grounded. And so there I was teaching in the airborne program, knowing that I would probably never fly again because I had a kidney issue. But after going to intermediate Chinese, I went to Korea to work on the drone project. And then I went back to advanced Chinese and thought I was going to go to Taiwan, but ended up going back to Goodfellow to be an instructor again. And while I was there, my wife received notice that her mom had cancer and was going to be leaving us within 5 or 6 months. I applied for a humanitarian assignment. And because of the rules in place at the time, because my wife was still a Japanese citizen, I couldn't come back to the 90th. So I applied to be a first sergeant. I applied to go to the command post. And in its infinite wisdom, the Air Force sent me to supply as a box kicker, and which kind of surprised me because supply was overmanned, and nobody knew what to do with a master sergeant Chinese linguist in supply. But it turned out it was a plot to get me back to the 90th in a non-flying slot. A guy named Chief Master Sergeant Ron Davey, who is long gone, orchestrated it, and then fate got in the way again, and the 90th went through one of its changes from a group back to a squadron, and the slot disappeared. So I was stuck in supply. About that time, I was taking graduate level education classes And unbeknownst to me, several of the people that were in the class worked at the NCO Academy. And as we neared the end of the first class, they invited me to be a staff member. And I told them, hey, I probably can't get released from security service, even though I'm in supply. And they said, well, it doesn't hurt to ask. And General Larson was the commander of USAFIS at the time. He said, yeah, I like my people in those positions. So they released me to the NCO Academy. And I finished out my career working first as the commandant of the leadership school. And then I made chief and became the commandant of the NCO Academy. And then I retired. Air Force here in a nutshell.
Yeah, that is an entire career. And it's amazing. It's amazing to hear how your journey started, you know, starting off going to the first ever Chinese DLI class and going to Japan and leaving Japan to go to Texas and then back here again. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's a marvelous journey, and I'd do it all again.
Was there any level of culture shock for you coming from, you know, coming from America and going all the way to Okinawa?
Some of the culture shock was kind of minimized because of the culture things they made us do while we were in Monterey. You know, Monterey is probably one of the most multicultural towns in all the United States. You know, going through class, we had to go to movies and social events and things primarily to practice the language, but it introduced us to a lot of Asia. And I also had a roommate who was several years older than me that had already been introduced to Japanese food. And there was a great Japanese restaurant downtown Monterey. So I had some exposure to it. It was still a bit of a shock. You know, you get off the plane. For one thing, the plane that I was taken to Tokyo, to Yokota, military contract flight, landed at Tachikawa for some reason. And I never did find out why. You know, wasn't weather. It was a beautiful day. But my roommate and I, who were traveling together, we were the only ones on the flight who were going to the 6988th, and we had no sponsor meet us. So the shock was trying to figure out, how in the heck do I get to Yokota, and where is it? With a bunch of people that didn't speak English. And yeah, Certainly didn't speak Chinese. That was the real culture shock. But beyond that, you know, once you started associating with the people of Japan and then subsequently the people of Okinawa, they're really decent people in most cases. You know, they have their bad eggs just like everybody else, but they were willing to forgive American stupidity and help me out. So the culture shock was really kind of minimized.
Yeah, and I'm sure it was a different time for you back then, because now we, you know, those of us who live here in Okinawa, we get the benefit of years and years of American culture being tied in with Okinawan culture. And so really, a lot of us can get away with not speaking Japanese at all. To go through what you went through at a time when there weren't so many English speakers, you know, I can only imagine what it was like, but you made it sound like everybody was really friendly and really helpful.
Yeah, they were. And, you know, it was a really hectic time within the 6988 itself, because the Vietnam conflict had taken off and the powers that be found out that the reconnaissance people could actually add value to the mission. So it was a constant flow of people. In fact, that's why I had no sponsor. He was TDY to Vietnam. And I actually didn't meet him until after I PCS to the 6990th, which I thought was ironic, because we were on opposite crews, and if he was in Yokota, I was in Vietnam. Kind of a side story, I like to tell people I was so geographically challenged that when they told me I was going to be a Chinese linguist, I thought that would keep me out of Vietnam. And when I got to Monterey and I started seeing maps of China and things like that, I had one of those oh crap moments when I realized that, geez, they're neighbors. And then later on, it became obvious that China was helping Vietnam. And I thought, I guess I'm probably going to end up there. And I did. And don't regret it, though. It's just one of those things. There's more culture shock in Vietnam than actually the culture shock of being in Japan and in Okinawa.
So were you on the ground then in your time in Vietnam?
On the ground in the sense that I was TDY there. The standard mission at Yokota, and if you talk to some of the other guys, they can tell you if I'm wrong. But traditionally, we spent about 19 days every month TDY there. And that started as soon as you were qualified. And because of the conflict going on and the pace of people coming in, qualification was pretty darn quick. I arrived in Yokota at, I think, close to the end of April. And I went in my TDY the beginning of June. I mean, that's how I was qualified to be on my own before May was over. I actually had no training missions because, again, quirk of fate, my trainer was deployed and I got on the airplane and there was no one there to train me. So a Korean linguist on a position beside me helped me out. And at the end of the day, he told the mission supervisor, yeah, to just qualify him. So they made me take the ground test and I passed them. And they said, okay, you're a Cat 2, which is, you know, minimally qualified. So I never technically flew a training mission at Yokota.
Do you think you can tell us, you know, at least in an unclassified way, what some of your missions were like? You know, especially for those of us who are history buffs and really interested in, you know, what it was like being a linguist in a Cold War. Yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, at Yokota, they had the first mission I was on, the pilot knew he had a new kid on board, so they actually did a circle around one of the active volcanoes in Japan so that I could see it. TDYs to Vietnam, you would get there, you would fly there. The next day, you would fly a late mission. And then I think we were off the third day, but the standard rotation was you flew an early mission, then you flew a late mission the next day, then you were off a day, and then you did it again. Of course, when I say off, that meant you went and transcribed. So the 19 days you were there, you really had no days off. You just worked. And then you flew a mission on the way back to Japan. It was actually kind of fun. Young and dumb, I thought it was adventurous. An old guy like me now, you try to tell me I'm going to do that, I'd probably just, you know, roll up in a fetal position and say, never mind. Because once we moved down to the 90th, you know, the 90th flew its first mission on the 12th of September and it aborted. But by the end of September, again, the people that were engaged in managing the conflict realized that intel could add a lot of value. And the mission came out to move to 24-hour coverage in the Gulf of Tonkin. Those were the only missions. Later on, they added missions in Laos. At one time, I think we had 6 airplanes here plus 1 TDY from Alaska. And they kept pretty busy. But 18-hour missions, 18 and a half hours. If you were on a morning mission, the bus picked you up at the barracks at about 11:30. We went over to the Strickland Dining Facility, midnight meal, which was probably one of the best meals on base at the time. Went to the SAC headquarters, which is, I think now, it's building 3524. I think is used to be the Strategic Air Command headquarters. We would do that portion of the pre-mission briefing, and then we go back to what is now Larson Hall, and we would do the classified portion of the mission briefing. And takeoff was 3:30 in the morning, get on orbit about 6, stay there for 12 hours, and then fly back to Yokota. Of course, if you were an MB, that meant you were on position the whole time.
During those times, were you, you were married during those times as well, right?
I was not married then. I was a single guy, but I was living with my soon-to-be wife.
Okay. And how was that? I mean, how was your work-life balance at that time?
Yeah, even that time, there is, you know, it was certainly mission first. You know, the Air Force requirement was you couldn't fly more than 100 hours a month, 300 hours a quarter, 1,200 hours a year or something like that. But that was waived so much that from the time I flew my first mission, I actually flew on the second mission out of Yokota or out of Kadena for the 90th. From there until I failed my flight physical in November of 1969, I flew 113 missions. Now, if you add that up at 18, 19 hours a whack, that's way above what you're allowed to do. We had these blanket waivers that said, you know, go fly, young man. And we did. The guys who were married, I imagine it was tough. But for those of us that were single, a lot of people volunteered to do things like Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, so that the married guys could be off if possible. And it's still a trend that I think happens.
Absolutely still happens.
We worked, if you weren't flying, we worked shifts. The standard shift is we went from being four on, you know, 4 days, four swings, four mids, to 6 days, six swings, six mids. Occasionally you get 3 days off and it was really pleasant. No such thing as holidays and weekends. It was just essentially nonstop. And I have to say, being young, I loved it.
That sounds awesome.
I couldn't wait to fly. I was very blessed, and not only the way the airplanes were configured at the time, the lead MB sat to the immediate left of the mission supervisor, the analyst sat to the immediate right of the mission supervisor, so you were right there at the hub of things. The lead MB was also responsible for recording and listening to the guard channel, so you heard a lot of the chatter during strikes in Vietnam. You heard people in emergency procedures. You heard people dying. It was an exciting time, but you know, it's sometimes terrifying, sometimes boring. You know, whoever said that flying on an airborne mission was hour after hour of endless boredom interrupted by sheer terror was absolutely correct. That seemed to be the way the missions went.
And so, yeah, speaking of which. Would you say that you had any notable missions that you can talk about?
Probably the most notable mission I had is when the Navy picket ship thought that a North Vietnamese MiG-21 was chasing us. And they kept reporting it closing into our rear. And of course, we were fleeing the northern Gulf of Tonkin as fast as we could. And it kept getting closer. And we always had bar cap at the time, normally Navy F-4s, F-8s, depending on what was available. But the bar cap had been off refueling, so they came scrambling back and lined up behind this MiG, which was closing on us. It was something like 18 miles behind us, rapidly getting ready to come into missile range. We were in a bit of a panic. The co-pilot was kind of looking out the window, and he could see the contrails, and he said something like, "They launched a missile." And, you know, being intel folks in the airborne war, we knew that the missile had a burn time of 7 seconds, so somebody immediately started counting. A lot of people slammed into their parachutes. And about that time, he said he launched another one. You know, if you picture it, you've got this, our aircraft, and behind it is this MiG, and behind it is the Navy launching at it. You know, that's not inherently a very safe thing from my point of view. But anyway, yeah. They hit it on like the third shot, and they reported that the pilot parachuted, and they saw it, saw the parachute landing in the water, and they saw the parachute waving, the pilot waving. This is what the Navy reported. And of course, we're on our way home. We've already aborted, people cleaning their pants and stuff like that. We get home, we find out that it wasn't a MiG, it was a drone. It was one of our drones that if we'd have had the right frequency, we'd have heard the Navy guy say, "That's my drone," or the Air Force guy say, "That's my drone, that's my drone, that's my drone." And you know, that's one of those you never forget. You know, for one thing, you think you're going to die. And for another thing, you're incredibly happy you didn't. And then you get home and you find out it was all a mistake.
Yeah, that's a roller coaster.
Some of the other notable things mostly happened on the guard channel. You know, I listened to a 3-star general being shot down and then subsequently rescued. I heard a lot of non-rescues, heard some amazing people, and then heard some funny things too. Monitoring guard was always a trip, especially on slow missions at night. You get some idiot up there blowing in his microphone, testing, doing sound checks, And the Australian, I think they were B-57 pilots, used the call sign Yellowbird. I can remember one guy calling up and saying, "Mate, you've been blowing in my ear for half an hour. When are you going to kiss me?" You know, stuff like that. Funny things that happened in the midst of, conflict. Yeah. Mission-wise, there was always something happening. I mean, they were watching us all the time.
And so after your time here and doing all those missions, what was it like transitioning to a teaching position? And then afterwards, transitioning from that into a non-security squadron type of position, like working in supply?
Transitioning into teaching was actually a real challenge for me. I had some experience as a trainer when I was at the 90th, particularly after I got grounded. Colonel Larson at the time said, "How about working in training and train the new Jeeps?" And that was fun, but the whole idea of getting up in a formal setting terrified me. I tell people that I used to get physically ill before I had to do a class, and that was in the instructor school itself. One of the instructors recommended I join Toastmasters, and I did, and they certainly help you get over the fear of speaking. Eventually, I fell in love with it. That led me later on in life to pursue a master's in education, simply because, one, it was available when I was needed it, and I thought I wanted to be a teacher when I left the military. Fortunately, I was smart enough to realize that I didn't particularly like working with kids, so I wanted to be an adult teacher. I wanted to work at the college level. Transitioning into non-security service units was difficult. In security service, we didn't have an abundance of officers. In fact, when the 90th started, we had a commander and an ops officer. That was it. Eventually, we got a vice commander and then a squadron section commander, but everybody else was enlisted. The flight commanders, for lack of a better word, were enlisted. In fact, tech sergeant was pretty common to be in charge of a flight. Everything was based on, I won't say everything, most things were based on skill, your ability as a operator, as a performer, rather than your rank. I mean, rank was certainly important, but skill was more important in, say, 90-95% of the time. When I transitioned to what we call the real Air Force, particularly like supply, I was a master sergeant, and they put me down in a warehouse, and I don't know what to do, so I started asking the airmen to teach me, and they found that to be a shocking concept, that someone who outranked them that much wanted to be taught by them and would actually listen to them. I also learned, particularly after I got into PME, that the longer you stick around and the higher you get, the more political it gets. I didn't see that in USAFIS. I don't know if it's still that way, but the technical skills, especially during the Vietnam conflict, were the most important thing. When I worked with the drone project, I saw some of the politics that I didn't see because we didn't have the ground troops here, but a large ground-based mission, and there was a lot of animosity between ground and airborne, even though we weren't flying. We had the drone flying for us. That was somewhat uncomfortable, and I understand that was kind of normal for people that were co-located with ground units, but it was nothing like the real Air Force. Transitioning to the civilian community was even more difficult, because one of the things I discovered was when you're in the military, you're always training somebody to do your job. I mean, that's our thing. We're always training. And it wasn't a shame to say, I don't know what I'm doing. Help me here. In the civilian community, if I asked somebody to teach me what they were doing, in 99 times out of 100, they'd tell me no. And I couldn't figure out why initially, and I finally realized is they're afraid you're going to take their job. So the camaraderie, the sharing, the willingness to follow orders was not there, particularly the camaraderie. I think in some ways that's kind of why I hung around the military, other than the fact that my wife is here and this is her home. I stayed working with or for or around the military my entire career. my whole working life, and part of that is because of the camaraderie.
Do you feel like some of the skills that you gained during your time in a security service served you well in the other parts of your career? And if so, what were those skills?
Absolutely. Certainly the teaching skill, the ability to work with adults and help them learn things. And when I went back to Goodfellow for my second tour, I started out back in the airborne shop, but I was moved to curriculum development, day lady. And I thought I was going to hate it. And it turned out that I discovered that I really enjoyed course design, course development. When I came back to Okinawa in 1979 on the humanitarian assignment, I decided I wanted to get a master's degree. And they had a master's in education, and one of the options was educational development, curriculum design. And because of my experience working as an instructor and because of the curriculum design at Goodfellow, I literally fell in love with it. I retired when I did because I had the opportunity to take over what was then Los Angeles Metropolitan College. The timing worked out great. Unfortunately, before I retired, somebody decided that they needed somebody with a doctorate, and they hired somebody else to take over the college leadership position. And fortunately, they still hired me to be a curriculum developer. It's just as well, because I realized once I got into the civilian education system that, it wasn't the same. It was at a leadership focused, at least, it was about the money. You know, how do we make more money? How do we make more money? At the teacher focus, you could, focus on students, but at the leadership, how do we generate more income? Kind of shocked my system.
Yeah. Yeah. So your master's in education development, that wasn't your only advanced degree, was it? You had a couple other ones.
Yeah. Those subsequently came later. After I only lasted a year. Fortunately, I only had a 1-year contract with the college. And I think I said Los Angeles Metropolitan College. It was actually Central Texas College. Yeah, I only had a 1-year contract with them. So when it ended, I ended up getting a job at the Family Support Center. And at the time, Family Support Centers were relatively new. They did assessment counseling and things like that. And I got interested in human resources, human relations. And I ended up getting a master's in human relations with a focus on conflict resolution. So, and that served me well. Later on, I worked for the services squadron, and I ended up working as the human resources officer because I had that background, which literally came about because of working in the military and working with the military. And then I left services and started my own company, working as a management consultant, traveling around the Pacific, mostly working with the military, teaching conflict management and management skills. And at the time, I saw people who were, with 2 master's degrees, I could demand a pretty good fee, but I saw people that had doctorate degrees who could demand twice what I did. It was not unusual in those days for someone with a doctorate to make $1,000 a day plus expenses for doing workshops on base. So I decided, with my wife prodding me, that, I'm going to get a doctorate, and I'll make that money too. So I went to attended an online college called then it was called Toro University International. Toro College is a fairly popular college in New York City, which is ironic. It's a Jewish college, and I'm Irish Catholic. And later on, I worked with a Jewish guy who went to a Jesuit college. We thought that was funny. But I got a PhD in business administration, with the whole idea that when my wife got ready to retire, she was working ironically at the Family Support Center as the cultural awareness person. And when she got ready to retire, she agreed that I would go back to being a management consultant and we would travel together. When I was doing it before, she got really tired because, unfortunately, I became too popular and I would be gone, sometimes 18, 19, 20 days a month. And she didn't like that. But the idea was I would do it again and she would travel with me. And we were kind of looking forward to it. And again, fate popped up. University of Phoenix got the contract for the military graduate education program on Kadena. And they offered me a job as a department chair right here on Kadena. I'd be responsible for all the campuses in Pacific, including Guam and two or three in mainland Japan and a couple in Korea. And wow. I ended up working for them for 7 years and teaching at the same time. And then finally decided, when they decided not to renew the contract, I decided, yeah, I think I'll quit. So I retired. And I've been retired now since 2016 and loving every bit of it.
Yeah, and that's your, you know, to keep it separate from your Air Force retirement, that's your real retirement.
Thanks to my wife, every time I got a pay raise, I would up my 401k and my retirement pay. So when I retired, we were far more comfortable than we ever thought we would be. So wow. We've had the luxury of not having to go to work. I joke every once in a while because I kind of miss teaching, particularly I miss working with doctoral level students. But every time I think I want to go back to work, I just take a nap till that urge goes away.
So, you know, I feel like this is something that's relevant to, you know, a lot of people in this career field and in general. How do you feel like your time, both going through language study with the military and in your time in the military, how do you feel like that's benefited you in pursuing your education, if it has?
For one thing, you sure get used to going to school. You know, you got to admit, the language training, the original MAFAC course was only 32 weeks, and it was intense. It was just like the screening. You know, every 6 weeks you had a test, and if you didn't pass the test, you were gone. We started out with 92 students in my class, and we only had like 30 of us get to Goodfellow. You know how intense it is when you start to dream in the language.
Yeah.
That's you've probably been there. That's kind of freaky. When you go through something that's that intense, and then you follow it on with the technical schools that are equally intense, and even the survival school, which certainly helps your confidence. Any civilian education after that is kind of easy. I don't want to say easy because you still have to work for it, but the pressure's not there. And my undergraduate education, I actually thought was more difficult than graduate level education, because at the graduate level, if you can write and talk, you're golden. At the undergraduate level, you got lots of tests. So, you know, in the particularly the profession, the airborne profession, stand eval requalifications, emergency procedures tests, airborne qualification tests, all those things certainly prepare you for taking non-life-threatening tests in the academic environment. So the military definitely helped me prepare. And I think almost most of my contemporaries who had gone the same route would say the same thing. When you got to school, you really had no fear of the education.
That's great. So yeah, let's talk about your time in Okinawa. So you've been living here since 1979, is that right?
Yeah, January 15th, 1979 is when I arrived back on my humanitarian. Air Force told me I would be here a maximum of 18 months. I haven't left yet.
And during this time, you know, you've managed to live in Ona and see it grow. What has that been like? You know, during your time here, what have you observed that's changed about Okinawa during the past 41 years?
You know, I missed the reversion to Japan because I managed to be back in the States when that happened. But having been here when it was under military control, we did not invest the money in the infrastructure and the island to the extent that the Japanese did immediately after they took over. So it used to be, when I was here in 1967, if you wanted to drive to Okuma, it was an all-day adventure. You know, and now from where I live in Ona, I can get to Okuma in like an hour and 10 minutes. Highway 1, which is what Highway 58 was known at the time, was only two lanes. And if you can remember, if you drove up to the north, where the if you remember where the Renaissance Resort Hotel is, if you followed that road that kind of weaves its way back down toward Yomitan, that was actually the main highway between Kadena and Nago. The Japanese called it the Highway of 77 Turns because it was just such a, it literally followed the coast. It was kind of a fun ride, but it would take a long time to get to Okuma. And on the eastern side of the island, there was no real road that went past where Camp Schwab is now. Mm. You know, literally from Nago north on the eastern side of the island, there were no roads. The only way to get to Hato Point was to go up the western side. After the Japanese took over, probably the biggest change has been in infrastructure. The highways are kind of marvelous. It's Okinawa is kind of like we used to joke about in the military. You know, if it doesn't move, paint it. Okinawa is that kind of way. If it's empty, build something there. When we built our house in 1986, I couldn't borrow the money to build a house while I was on active duty because the Japanese said, well, you can just be sent away. And my wife, because she was married to me, even though she was working as an MLC, Japanese civilian employee, and made enough money to borrow money, because she would probably go with me, they wouldn't lend us the money to build a house. So in 1986, we were up here driving around in the Oni area, and we saw a new housing development area, bunch of land. And we saw a plot we liked, and we asked the salesperson, you know, how much is it? And he told me, and I said, can I get you to hold us a piece of land? And he said, yeah, but I'll need the money by, and he gave me the date. And this was like a Friday or a Saturday, and I only had 5,000 yen with me. He held the land for us with 5,000 yen on the condition that I have enough money to make a down payment on Monday. Well, the Pentagon Federal Credit Union was kind enough to lend me the money for the down payment, so we made a down payment on the property and then managed to get a Japanese bank to loan my wife enough of it. And the only reason I could do it is because I had retired from the military. Even though I was working as a GS, or actually I was working for the college at the time, even though I was working as a civilian, I didn't have the stigma of being military can be sent away. So we borrowed the money to buy the land, and then we used the collateral from that, plus an old guy who used to come to the NCO club and play the slots, agreed to co-sign for us, an old Japanese gentleman. And we borrowed the money to build the house. So it was built in, I retired in 86, the house was built in 87. And we've lived here ever since. But scary thing was, my wife was working, I mentioned, as a MLC, a Japanese employee, which meant she was paid in yen. The day I borrowed the money to build my house, the yen rate was 265 yen to the dollar. The day we moved into my house, the yen rate was 170 to the dollar and plummeting. It got down to 97 yen to the dollar. I thought my retirement pay would make my house payment and my utilities and everything. It didn't even come close. And if my wife had not been paid in yen, we'd have probably lost the house the first year.
Wow.
Yeah. But she was being paid in yen, thank God. And we went through 2 years where we literally paid nothing on the principal. We only paid interest. It was kind of interesting. You know, it was worth it in the long run. It was kind of scary, you know. Here you are. You just retired. You think you're living pretty. And I can't imagine, you know, now we're in the middle of all this coronavirus stuff and all the people, you know, losing jobs and bankruptcy pretty much worldwide.
Yeah.
I can empathize with them. When you're worried about losing everything. But the bright side is my wife, again, bless her heart, convinced me it's only a thing. As long as you have life, you can always get things. So kind of shifted my focus to make it life livable.
That's really good.
Yeah. The other thing that's changed is like when we built our house, my wife Eiko told her girlfriend about we bought this property. So her girlfriend went and tried to buy the plot beside us. Couldn't get it because somebody had already bought it. But two lots down she bought. And her husband was already retired and making extra money. And she had a job, so they immediately started to build. So hers was the first house in the neighborhood. Ours was the second house. And now there's probably, I don't know, 200-300, including some apartment buildings and the dormitory for the Renaissance Resort. I look at it on Google Earth. In fact, I was just looking this morning trying to figure out if it's a school they built up north of us. The amount of construction is just amazing. And that's true everywhere. The one pretty day we had earlier this week, we decided to ride up the east coast of the island to Hado and then back down through Nago. We hadn't been up that way in probably 3 months, 4 months. And we were amazed at the amount of new buildings that have appeared.
Wow, yeah.
You know, I'm sure we probably saw the construction, but we didn't pay any attention to it. But it's like it's nonstop building. And yet we commented, there's still a lot of open ground in Okinawa.
Yeah, and so I guess for the people who maybe aren't familiar with Okinawa, or really for all the people who are, you know, back in the States and kind of pine for their days of living back in Okinawa, could you describe for us what your neighborhood is like?
My neighborhood is about 95% Okinawan. Although I say Okinawan, that's not necessarily true. Japanese. We've had a fairly large influx of people from mainland Japan who have either bought summer houses in Okinawa or have moved here and decided to stay here. So very few Americans. There are a couple of apartment buildings that rent to Americans. And a couple of places have just recently been built that are kind of like timeshares. They cater primarily to Chinese tourists. So we have quite a bit of Chinese families or Chinese groups living in the neighborhood at times. That's certainly cut back over the last couple of months. I live in Onish. A year and a half or so after we built the house, the government of Okinawa decided that Ona would become the resort area. Yep. And the northeastern part of Japan would become a sea preserve, national park kind of thing. So no hotels were allowed to be built over there, but Yomitan and Ona specifically, was deemed a resort area. And this is where most of the hotels have been put up, the tourist hotels. Within about 10 miles of me, I have 17 or 18 major hotels. And I mean 300, 400, 500. The Hyatt Regency opened last year. I can't remember the name of the Hawaiian one that just opened. It's a huge hotel. Haven't been there yet. Just tons and tons of resort hotels. The downside of that is my wife and I joke about Ona has no major supermarkets, no libraries, no hospitals. We just have restaurants and resorts. And OIST.
I never thought about that.
Yeah, we have OIST. In fact, coming back from our ride earlier this week, I made the observation that I never noticed before. There's no drive-in restaurants in Ona. We don't have a Mos Burger or a McDonald's or any of those.
Oh, yeah.
And I just never really noticed that. So that has changed. The people have become more vocal in their anti-base, but a lot of people think that means they're anti-Americans, and nothing could be further from the truth. The Okinawans are probably some of the most laid-back people in the world. Very accepting, very tolerant, fun to associate with. Eat some weird food, but that's kind of goes with the territory.
Of course.
I'm sure it came about from starvation days after World War II when pigs were first reintroduced to Okinawa, but they literally eat every part of the pig. I mean, pig's feet, pig's ears, you name it, it's edible. And I've just never been able to get into pig's ears and pig's feet. I like the rest of it. Like I mentioned, the people there are pretty laid back, except on the highway. They drive like crazy. I can't figure out, you're on an island, where are you going to go? I saw a report here sometime last year that Naha is ranked among one of the top 10 congested cities in all of Japan for traffic.
That's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, but it's true. Nothing compared to, you know, I spent 2.5 hours stuck on the Shuto Expressway trying to get to the hotel in downtown Tokyo once. It's nothing like that, but it's still hectic traffic. The bypass, first on the expressway bypass, and the one they just made that goes on the other side of Camp Kenzer, has really cut down on the traffic on Highway 58. So it's not nearly as congested as it was just a year and a half ago. That's the kind of the way things change. for people that have been here, you can drive out of the airport now, take a tunnel that goes under the bay and a bridge that goes across the next bay up by Naminue, and then the bypass on the west side of Camp Kinzer, and you can literally go from the airport to Kadena in like 40 minutes. When it was only 58, you always left yourself three and a half hours to get to Naha Airport. Now, you know, hour and a half should be plenty of time. That's a major difference. Other differences, what, pachinko parlors? My goodness, there's pachinko parlors everywhere.
Yeah.
Make Man, once upon a time, there was only one Make Man, and it was packed. Now there's six or seven Make Mans. Most Americans think of them as the monkey store because they got a DIY monkey on the sign. They're, you know, literally you can buy anything. Malls, the Aeon Mall out in Rycom Plaza.
Oh, yeah.
Can certainly compete with any mall in the United States.
Parco City now.
Oh, Parco City. We went down there one time because my niece's husband works there. We're not big mall fans. In fact, we avoid them. But you have to go see them at least, you know, once.
Of course.
And they're amazing. The road that goes by Parco City, by the way, is the one I was talking about that's on the
that's
west
right.
side of Kinzer. I can remember right where the road goes. Once upon a time, Kinzer used to have this awesome beach, and you could take Naha Air Base was there, and you could take, boats out on the water and stuff like that. It was a lot of fun. Of course, now, just in time for the travel to be pretty much stymied because of coronavirus, the second runway opened at Naha Airport, and that literally gives them the capability of getting more than a million tourists a year, which has been one of their targets, and they got real close to it last year. Would have probably broken that record this year. That's one of the benefits of coronavirus, by the way, is traffic's been very light. I kind of enjoyed that, but someday.
Yeah, it is nice.
And this is something else. Speaking of tourists, when I got here in 1979, the number one industry was sugarcane. That was soon overtaken by export flowers because for many flowers like chrysanthemum and stuff like that, the Okinawans can literally squeeze three growing seasons out by using artificial lights and greenhouses. So we essentially became, you know, the flower garden for Japan, particularly in winter. That kind of led to the development of many of the dams we have because flowers are a very water intensive resource. And we went through lots of water rationing in the early days. Now there are enough dams that unless we get a, you know, like a 2-year drought, we're probably in good hands with just rainfall. And rain like we're getting right now certainly is helping put the reservoirs back at 100%. That's a major change. But tourism became our number one industry with export flowers behind that. And then government is actually third now. Once upon a time, government was literally first. I failed to mention that. Government has actually fallen into like third place in terms of industry. But tourism and this restrictions on travel has really, really hurt the Okinawan economy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know they're probably looking forward to the people coming back. I'm looking forward to going back to resort hotels after things quiet down, if they quiet down. So, because that was our, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks, you know, go dine at one of the resort hotels. Kind of miss that.
Yeah, I'm hoping it comes back soon. I'm hoping.
Yeah, well, today we hit 3 weeks without a case.
Yeah.
For Okinawa, and that includes we had a fairly large number of people come during Golden Week, not anywhere near 50. I think they said 59% down from last year.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
We had like 60,000 people come to the hotels. I mean, there were 60,000 reservations. Don't know if they took all of them. But, you know, people are kind of watching to see if there'll be any spike after the tourists. And so far, looking good.
Yeah, so far, so good. Let's see. Just kind of to wrap things up, I had one more question, but now you actually caused me to think about another one. So is there any Okinawan food that you would say you've become a pretty big fan of, but maybe other people would not be so, you know, eager to try right away?
Yeah, Goya. Goya it translates to English as bitter melon. First time I tasted it, I thought, God, this is nasty. I have learned to really, really like it. I like Goya salad. I like Goya champuru, which is Goya cooked with tofu and bean sprouts and normally bell peppers or something green. And the Okinawans like to use Spam in it. I use pork. But I've really gotten into those. It's kind of a both Japanese and Okinawan tofu called Yushi tofu, which is a real soft tofu used to make like a soup. First time I saw it, I said, you know, pardon me. I said, this looks like somebody threw up. Now I love it. Yeah, so those are two of the things I really like. And just in pure Japanese food, man, give me sushi. I like sushi. And some of the local fish, gurikun, saba-sama, I like those, along with the traditional shrimp and octopus and tuna.
Yeah, I cannot wait for the restrictions to lift and we can have, you know, just dine in and enjoy sushi once again.
Yeah.
And tsukumen. I think that's one thing for us.
Oh, you like that?
Yeah, big time. It's one of those things that you can't really just, you know, order takeout. And even if you could, it wouldn't be as good. So, yeah, that's going to be one thing for us. And yakiniku, yeah, all these things. I mean, I can go on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, one of my retirement, since I retired 4 years ago, I've gotten into baking and cooking. And over the last year or so, I've gotten into being adventurous and trying Japanese cooking. Up until then, my wife would cook Japanese. I'd cook kind of Western American. I kind of like doing stir fries and stuff like that. I've really enjoyed it. So I don't miss it quite as much as I probably would. But sometimes you get really tired of your own cooking.
I can see that. Yeah. I hear you. Yeah. So I guess to wrap it up, do you have any words of wisdom for anybody who's still serving, whether they're in the security service or even in the military in general, or really just anybody who, you know, anybody who cares to serve the country?
Yeah, probably the best advice I'd give to anybody, and this applies whether you're in a domestic location or an overseas location, is get off base. You know, especially if you're young, don't be afraid to try something. I had a very wise mentor tell me when I first got to Japan, don't ask what something is until you taste it and decide whether or not you like it.
And that's a good one.
That's turned out to be good advice, because if somebody had told me, you know, you're going to eat, you know, octopus eggs or something like that, I'd have said, no way in hell. But I love octopus. I love, you know, essentially caviar and stuff like that that I would never, ever have tried. And the same thing is true with talking to the people.
Yeah.
Adventuring, give it a try. The same thing applies, I think, in the military. Don't be afraid to try. And for the linguists, every chance you get, transcribe. There's no better way to develop your language skills than really digging into something difficult. Well, you know, I mentioned one of the things in the military, particularly in my experience with security service and electronic security command, was people were always willing to say, hey, help me. And there was always someone willing to try to help. A lot of that was the technical being more important than the rank. I can remember we had a master sergeant who came from what was then Ona Point, came down to join us in flying status. And he wasn't afraid to ask three-striper Mel Hagen to help him transcribe. That's always been one of my highlights. He then went on to be my boss, so well, such is life. Glad I helped him.
That's great. Do you have any, do you have any more stories you'd like to share before we close out?
One of the things that people used to ask me when I first got back to the States is, why did I marry a Japanese? And I tell them, you know, I didn't plan on it. In fact, my grandfather specifically warned me against it. I just met somebody I fell in love with. And in order to do something like that, you've got to set aside a lot of your mindsets. And that same thing that enables you to maybe fall in love with somebody that's not like you is the same thing that'll stand you in good stead, particularly in a foreign country. Open mind, not willing to say, well, we don't do it that way. or that's wrong. In America, we do this. It's not a question of right or wrong. It's a question of different. So be open. You know, give it a try. You know, the military likes to say, don't volunteer. But the truth is almost all of my major experiences and successes have been because I was willing to volunteer. So on duty, off duty, give it a try.
That's perfect. And I think, those are the best closing words that we could ask for. So I'll stop the recording here, Chief. Seriously, thank you for your time.
Thank you. I look forward to hearing the edited version.